Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, a weekly mix of science interviews and local music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. We'll start with the scientist soundbite.
What struck me most powerfully was just how beautiful the continent is. It wasn't a scientific reaction, it was just a human emotional reaction. I've done 15 field seasons in Antarctica. I've seen a lot of the continent. But this view of Antarctica from space was stunning.
You're listening to NASA glaciologist Robert Binshadler. Since 1972, the Landsat mission has taken from space the longest-running record of changes happening on the surface of the entire planet. And the least explored place on Earth is the frozen continent of Antarctica, which surrounds the South Pole. Scientists recently created a mosaic of photographic images that show the complete Antarctica in amazing detail for the first time ever. It's called the Landsat Image Mosaic of Antarctica, or LIMA. Here to explain more is NASA's Robert Binshadler. He's led 15 science expeditions and helped develop the LIMA mosaic. Dr. Binshadler, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, I'd like to speak with you about the Landsat Image Mosaic of Antarctica. LIMA shows an amazingly detailed view of the entire frozen continent. How would you describe LIMA?
Well, the way I would describe LIMA is that it is the first true color, high definition view of Antarctica. It may sound surprising, but before LIMA, there was no mosaic at a high resolution of Antarctica that showed the continent in true color. All the other continents have been mosaiced, but Antarctica never was. So we set about to do this and do it better than any of the other mosaics, both for the public to see what Antarctica looks like in true color and high definition, but also for scientists to use the same data set to do various scientific studies.
Maybe you could give us a big picture here of what was gained in doing this and why it's different than what scientists knew before this Landsat image mosaic of Antarctica was put together.
Well, I think the fact that LIMA is in true color is particularly important because it gives scientists an early view of any area of the continent. It's a huge continent, and most of it still remains unexplored in any sort of detail. So if you're a geologist wanting to explore a particular mountain range, you're going to want to look at that mountain range before you go. So LIMA, as much as anything for that kind of planning, serves as a unique base map. And then it also shows, because it's in such high detail, particular features on the surface that a glaciologist, such as myself, can interpret to tell us about the ice sheet, where it's going fast, where it's going slow, which direction it's going. So there's just a variety of ways that such a unique data set can be used by scientists.
And maybe you could speak to how it's being used by non-scientists. What are some ways that anyone can use LIMA to find out more about Antarctica?
Right. One of the beauties of LIMA is that we put it together not only for scientists, but for people who are not conducting science down there, which obviously is the vast majority of people on the planet, to help them become more familiar with Antarctica. As I said, it's true color. This is what it would really look like if you were there. It's sort of akin to hovering around in a helicopter. You can go anywhere you want on the continent and see what it looks like. And it's a beautiful continent, and that alone, I think, is important. But here at NASA, we put together a website called lima.nasa.gov, where we've concentrated on the education and outreach aspects that LIMA provides. So we have some videos that explain how scientists are using the data. We have some exercises where people can track the motion of the ice using Landsat imagery. And we also have, for teachers, some formal lesson plans. So we're trying to use LIMA as a vehicle to connect people more closely with Antarctica because it is a part of our planet, and it's an important part of our planet, and we need to understand it better to appreciate it and understand that connection between what happens there and what happens in our life.
Now, as a scientist who's very familiar with what's happening in Antarctica, would you give us an update what's happening today in Antarctica and how scientists know this? What is some of the evidence that goes into knowing what's happening there?
Right. For me, the most important thing that's happening in Antarctica is that the ice sheet is changing. It's changing faster and faster. In general, it's shrinking. The ice shelves in the Antarctic Peninsula, some of them are disintegrating, just disappearing very rapidly. Other outlet glaciers are accelerating, and this is causing the ice sheet to shrink, and all that ice is going into the ocean, and it's raising sea level around the world. That's how it really connects to people around the world, is through its contribution to changing sea level. And we know that not only from the Landsat satellite, but from a whole host of satellites that NASA has looking at the Earth, and satellites turn out to be incredibly important in the polar regions because it's such a difficult area to make these types of measurements. So it's a whole host of data that we pull together to get this comprehensive picture of how rapidly and where the ice sheet is changing.
Well, Dr. Benchaler, thank you for speaking with us today. This is my final question. What's the most important thing you want people today to know about Antarctica and Landsat?
I think there really are two things that are very, very important. And the first is that Antarctica is changing, and it matters to everybody on the planet because those changes in the size of the ice sheet affect sea level. And as Antarctica is shrinking, sea level is rising, and that will continue and, in fact, probably intensify. That's the first important thing. And the second is that we only know these things because we are looking. And the primary way we look at Antarctica is from space. The whole suite of satellite sensors, Landsat being a very important part of a whole suite of sensors that look at Antarctica. And if we didn't do that, we wouldn't know any of these things are taking place.
You've been listening to NASA glaciologist Robert Binshadler. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science.
We spend our money on a pilgrimage. So we drove east where the magic is. Ourselves in the cheapest inn, in case we never come back again.
Find us as Earth Sky on Facebook, Earth Sky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. Deborah Bird joins us now to talk about the global night sky and how to spot planet Mercury. Deborah, tell us about it.
Hey, Jorge, how are you?
Fine.
And the planet Mercury is sometimes difficult to spot because Mercury is the closest planet to the sun. And some people think that means that Mercury is faint. It's not faint. In fact, it's one of the brightest planets. It's a very bright object in our sky, as bright as the brightest stars. But because Mercury is so close to the sun, it's always seen in the sky either in the west, just after sunset, close to the sunset glare, or in the east, just before dawn, close to the glare of dawn. So in March, March or April every year is always the best time to catch Mercury in the evening if it's up at that time. And this year, 2011, Mercury will be visible beginning in about the middle of March. So about the middle of March, 2011, is the time to start looking for the planet Mercury and to get to see it in the night sky.
So you said that that Mercury is bright, and maybe you could give us some tips on what to see, where to see it, and what to expect.
Well, Mercury is going to be in the west after sunset, and the very lucky thing about this year, 2011, is that there's another bright planet in the sky at the same time as Mercury around the middle of March. That planet is Jupiter. Jupiter is very, very bright. It's much brighter than Mercury. And in mid-March 2011, Jupiter and Mercury are going to be really close together in the western sky. So you're going to be standing there facing the direction that the sun went down. The sky is going to be getting dark. You're going to look toward that sunset direction. You're going to see two really bright objects. The brighter one is going to be Jupiter, and the fainter one, still pretty bright, is going to be the planet Mercury.
Why is it that, maybe you could explain for us, why is it that March seems to be the best month to catch Mercury?
Well, it's pretty cool. I mean, it's like you have to think about how we live in a solar system. So the solar system is our sun with planets orbiting around it. And all of the planets in our solar system orbit in more or less a flat plane. And in our sky, that plane of the solar system translates into kind of a pathway across the sky. And that's just the zodiac. You know, the zodiac means pathway of animals. It's the thing that the sun rises in the east and sets in the west and travels a particular path across the sky. That path of the sun is also the path of the moon, is also the path of the planets. So as Earth goes around the sun, that pathway, the zodiac, or as astronomers call it, the ecliptic, they call that band across the sky the ecliptic, its orientation with respect to the horizon changes from month to month. And in March, the ecliptic, or the path of the sun, moon, and planets, is pretty much straight up, pretty much perpendicular with respect to the horizon. And that's why in March, when the sun goes down, Mercury, which is on that pathway, instead of being, you know, if the ecliptic were flat down lying with a narrow angle to the horizon, it would be very low in the sky. But because the ecliptic is nearly straight up, that means that Mercury's distance from the sun is all up above the horizon. So that places Mercury high in the sky. And that's why Mercury is always easiest to see in the evening in March or April.
That's a great treat for sky watchers to be able to catch Mercury this March in the night sky.
Well, they used to say that less than 1% of Earth's population had ever knowingly seen the planet Mercury, and I think that's probably still true. So what's 1% of 7 billion, Jorge?
Well, that's still a lot of people. But, and we hope that that people listening can go outside and catch a clear night in the evenings, March evenings, and catch Mercury mid-month.
Well, Mercury is appearing in mid-month near the planet Jupiter. As the month progresses, Jupiter is going to be setting in the sunset glare. So by about March 20th, 21st, 22nd, 24th, somewhere in there, when you look out, you won't see Jupiter anymore. You'll just see a single bright object in the western sky after sunset. That'll be Mercury.
Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky is Deborah Bird, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science.
We'll see it all under this moon.
Earth Sky, heard on 1500 radio stations around the world. Now for some weird science with Ryan Britton on a true story of zombie ants. Ryan, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing great. So Ryan, what are zombie ants? Are they after us? Do we need to grab the kids and head for the hills? What's up?
Well, not just yet. These zombie ants, they reside deep in the Brazilian rainforest, and they're victims to a particularly nasty foe. It's a fungus that releases these small spores that get inside the ant either from the air or from the forest floor, and then once in, the fungus goes to work on the ant's head, hence zombie ants.
Sounds lovely. So what does it do to the ants?
Well, the fungus grows inside the ant, and then it does something very interesting. Just before it kills the ant, it makes the ant leave the colony and go and bite into a vein of a leaf or a plant that's nearby. This happens, again, just moments before the ant dies. So the last things these ants do is go off and bite a leaf, and then bam, they're dead. It's pretty nasty. The fungus continues to eat the dead ant from the inside out. And a couple of weeks later, the fungus actually sprouts from the ant's head in this ivory carnival headdress type of thing. This is what it looks like, and it releases from that that headdress spores that go and infect the other ants. So this is interesting too. If the spore doesn't land on an ant from the air, say it just falls and hits the ground, then the spore grows a secondary spore that sticks up in the air in hopes of grabbing the leg of a passing ant, and then getting into the ant that way. So then the circle of life for the fungus and death for the ant continues. This fungus is very effective at what it does. It can wipe out entire ant colonies and have their bodies strewn across the forest floor.
So Ryan, what's the science behind the weird? I mean, how does the fungus control the ant? How does it make the ant bite the leaf?
Scientists do not know. The chemicals released by the fungus obviously have something to do with it, but how the fungus controls the mind of the ant with these chemicals is just not understood. Keep in mind that the fungus wants to make the host ant go out into the open so it can release more spores, hence, biting on a leaf. The fungus is controlling the ant, but we're just not sure how yet.
And will the fungus come for humans next?
I'm not sure you can say that, but if something came along just like this, for us, it'd definitely have our attention.
And where can people find out more about zombie ants?
You can find more at lifescience.com and at The Guardian, which is guardian.co.uk.
Weird Science, Ryan Britton. Thanks, Ryan.
You're welcome.
And we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. You can find us on Earth Sky on Facebook, Earth Sky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. We're taking your questions on Facebook. To find us on Facebook, search for Earth Sky. Deborah Bird is back to tell us about the Mercury Messenger mission that NASA has sent to explore the first rock from the sun. Hi, Deborah.
Hey, Jorge. Glad to be back. A little earlier on the show, I was talking about seeing Mercury in the night sky. But as you're seeing it in the middle of March, you can also think about a little spacecraft that has been heading toward Mercury since 2004. That spacecraft is called MESSENGER. And it has been literally winding its way through the solar system since 2004. It's done one flyby of Earth, two flybys of Venus, and already three flybys of Mercury. But what's happening this month is that it's finally in a position where it can go into orbit around Mercury. It's going to do that on March 17th, 2011, and it will be the first spacecraft ever to orbit Mercury.
Isn't that amazing? The first spacecraft ever to orbit a planet just a couple of rocks down from us.
That's right. Mercury is the closest planet to the sun. And people at first didn't know much about Mercury. In fact, they used to call it the moon of the sun. They thought it always kept one face toward the sun. Now they know that's not true. They know that Mercury rotates slowly under the sun. And you were telling me earlier, Jorge, about some temperature data that you have there.
Well, right. It's a bit of a bipolar planet when it comes to temperature, in that temperatures on the surface can reach 400 degrees Celsius.
Oh.
And then they can plunge down to minus 180 degrees Celsius, depending on which part of the planet is facing the sun.
That's right. And that's all because Mercury is so close to the sun, and also because it doesn't have an atmosphere.
So I'm curious. I'm really interested. I mean, there are so many question marks when it comes to this planet, Mercury. Earlier, you were talking about how to find it. I guess humans have found it in a night sky, but we really don't know very much about it at all.
That's right. We do know that Mercury, past spacecraft missions have shown us that Mercury does look somewhat like our moon. It's airless. It's very gray looking. It's covered with craters. It doesn't have the mare, the volcanic lava flows that the moon has. So looking at the surface of Mercury, thinking about the geology of Mercury, what happened there in the past on this planet, also the space environment around Mercury, all of those things are going to be studied by the MESSENGER spacecraft as it orbits around the planet. And by the way, it's going to get very close to Mercury, as close as 124 miles.
Wow. You know, one thing I wanted to add to that was you mentioned the moon, and just in the past couple of years, there's been a lot of news about finding ice, finding water on the moon. And I believe that is one of the things that that scientists will be looking for on Mercury, whether there might be ice on the planet Mercury.
Oh, that's right. There are these craters on Mercury that are in permanent shadow. So even though Mercury is really close to the sun and it's incredibly hot on its surface, there are places on Mercury that are always in shadow where there might be ice, and scientists will be looking for that.
And the scientists will get a better understanding as the MESSENGER space probe orbits Mercury. It's supposed to be orbiting in mid-March, sometime later this month.
That's right. It'll go into orbit on March 17th, and they expect it to start, you know, doing some science. They have to check out all the equipment and so on, but then they expect it to start doing science in early April 2011.
Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky is Deborah Bird, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. That's our show. Thanks for joining us. Earth Sky 22 was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, the live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers, Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. And special thanks this week to our musical contributors, South by Southwest showcasing artists, The Eastern Sea, Leatherbag, The Bright Light Social Hour, The Black and White Years, and 100 Flowers. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next stage. There are so many artists, too much art, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next stage.